From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a fresh push for a part-time state legislature.
If you want sort of just good quality, good government kind of legislation, then you might not be in favor of a part-time legislature.
The Mackinac Policy Conference kicks off today, focusing on being civil to each other.
So that we can restore the art of compromise, and we seem to have lost that in this very polarized political environment.
The cost of Lansing's relentless push for tax cuts.
We've decided tax cuts are more important than funding education. It's stupid. It's exactly the wrong decision.
And the joys of bluegrass.
It just makes me want to dance. It makes me want to bounce. It makes me want to sing.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is speaking this afternoon at the Mackinac Policy Conference. Many observers believe he'll use the event on Mackinac Island to announce a ballot drive to make Michigan a part-time legislature state. Matt Grossman is an associate professor of political science at Michigan State University, where he directs the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research. Michigan is one of, what, only four states with a true full-time legislature?
Well, it depends how you count it, but yes, we're among the most professionalized.
And this is not the first time someone's tried to get this part-time legislature idea launched. So how come it hasn't happened in Michigan the way it has in most other states?
Well, there's certainly a public mistrust of legislatures, and there is kind of popular pressure to make changes, and people tend to support changes that bring the legislators down a peg. So it's sort of an open political issue for those who want to take advantage of it, and now it seems to be coming to Michigan.
Let's talk about the pros and cons. What do you see as the major pros and cons of a part-time legislature?
Well, I think that the associations that we've seen nationally are that if you want sort of just good quality, good government kind of legislation, then you might not be in favor of a part-time legislature. Less professionalized legislatures tend to produce less policy that wins awards or that's copied by other states, and more policy that gets overturned by the courts. So sort of quality as a metric might move you against a part-time legislature. But there are reasons why, especially conservative legislatures might favor this. It tends to lead, or at least be associated with, lower state spending overall, and it tends to be somewhat associated with Republican electoral gains as well. So there are reasons why conservative Republicans would be in favor, even at the cost of some quality.
I guess I'm wondering who stands to benefit the most when you see the way it's worked elsewhere.
Well, whenever you reduce the power of legislature, you tend to increase the power of others. So, for example, lobbyists tend to gain a more prominent role in less professionalized legislatures. If the legislature's only there part-time, there's still going to be others who are there all the time, including those that are trying to influence state policy. But one of the surprises is that it doesn't seem to be associated with gains for the governor. So one might think that bringing the legislature down a peg would help increase the governor's effectiveness, but there doesn't seem to be as much evidence of that.
You know, we already see this trend of inexperienced elected leaders coming to Lansing and then through term limits, they're kind of learning as they go, and they get shown the ropes by special interests and lobbyists. So going part-time, does that, in your view, even stack the deck more in favor of special interests and lobbyists?
Well, certainly the associations nationally are that you get more interest group mobilization and that the lobbyists are perceived as having more power in states with less professionalized legislatures. But I would say that this interacts with some other pieces that make our legislature less professionalized, term limits being the big one, and more professionalized. So we have centralized bill writing with the Legislative Services Bureau, and we have fiscal agencies in the House and the Senate that would remain. So the other possibility is that it would increase the power and the role of those independent legislative bodies that are also there all the time.
Let's talk a little more about term limits. There's this very consistent theme that we hear from people who were in state government before term limits, that Folks get elected to the state legislature, and just about the time they really start to get the hang of it, their term limited out, and here comes another group of green newbies. So many feel our state government has suffered from term limits. Would a part-time legislature make this cycle of inexperience even worse, in your view?
It certainly would move things in a similar direction. So both term limits and part-time legislatures are ways of making the legislature less professionalized, and they tend to have similar effects, or at least similar associations across other states that enact them. And they also tend to be enacted somewhat together. So it's not a surprise that a term-limited state would also be pushing more in this direction. But, of course, historically, we've had fairly strong legislative institutions in Michigan.
Let's say a proposal makes it on the ballot and voters say yes, and they approve the idea of having a part-time legislature. What needs to happen in your mind for us to have a smooth transition to a part-time one?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot depends on the details, of course, of how much part-time, and it also depends on the practice. So a lot of part-time legislatures end up just getting called back by the governor on a very regular basis, so they're not as part-time as they were initially intended. So we don't know if that will happen here. But certainly the same kinds of things that you worry about for term limits, you worry about for here. So we need well-trained and experienced politicians. We need well-trained and experienced staff, and we need a lot of support for those centralized institutions in the legislature and in the administration, like the services bureaus and the fiscal agencies. They're going to be our main bulwark against this having a negative effect on legislative quality.
Matt Grossman, Associate Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University, where he directs the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Matt.
Thank you.
For Michigan's elected officials like Lieutenant Governor Calley, for business leaders, and many in the media, the place to be is indeed Mackinac Island. Today marks the opening day of the 2017 Mackinac Policy Conference, put on by the Detroit Regional Chamber. 4 days of sessions, speeches, discussions, receptions, and networking. Here with us is Tammy Carnreich, the COO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. You usually choose three key issues or pillars on which to build the policy conference. What are they this year?
Our pillars for the 2017 conference are restoring civility in American politics, increasing economic opportunity, and winning the race in connected technology. So as you listen to those three, you can hear how very relevant all those topics are right now, not only in Michigan, but in our nation.
Well, in fact, let's dig in a little to this issue of restoring civility in American
Sure.
politics. Certainly, since Election Day and beyond, there has Mm-hmm. been a decided lack of that. But you actually chose this theme well before Election Day, didn't you?
We did. It was before Election Day, and if you remember, even before that, you could see the divide that was happening in our nation with candidates and what we believed, seeing what was happening at that time, how do you get to solutions? And so we thought it would be very important to get our business and civic leaders together to start talk about shaping public discourse, and so that we can restore the art of compromise. And we seem to have lost that in this very polarized political environment.
In fact, people are going to hear that theme of restoring civility, and they're going to go, really? And in this climate, do you believe it's possible?
Yes, they will. And, you know, they'll hear it from big-name speakers like Walter Isaacson and Michael Beschloss, and then from national insiders like Harold Ford Jr. and Stephanie Cutter and Anna Navarro. But one of the really very cool ones will be Julie Winokur. And she has something called Bring It to the Table, and she actually travels all over the United States with a card table and a picnic table cover on it, and she just brings people together to talk about things and understand why they don't disagree. She may ask them a question on an issue and let them talk through where they come from, you know, with different perspectives. So our audience is going to get a really interesting, diverse combination of discussion around political civility.
Increasing economic opportunity for all is one of the pillars. How does the chamber see a pathway to that when, to many in this state, it seems like only a very few are making all the decisions, are calling all the shots, and actually a lot of them will be on Mackinac this week?
It's a very good question, Cynthia. And what the chamber recognizes is that in Michigan, and for us in Southeast Michigan also, there's great things happening. We've got development underway. We have job creation underway. But we still have a lot of areas that need to be brought along. And it's that economic inclusion that we have to start talking about. And we have some very important people who are going to be giving their thoughts on how we can do that from a policy standpoint, and they're going to be differing opinions. We really encouraged that so that we really start to think about what we have to do as a state. But then we're also going to hear from an expert, Amy Liu, from the Brookings Institute, who travels the country and sees what other cities are doing around sustainable development and economic inclusion. Because if we don't do this, then all the other economic strategies aren't going to work.
For those who don't have direct business at the conference, people who are not elected officials or business leaders or media, why should they care about what happens this week on Mackinac?
Because what happens on Mackinac is very much about all elements of our society. It's about how business, government, philanthropy, not-for-profit, education, we're all important to succeed in long-term strategies. So while people may not be able to be here at the conference for one reason or another or choose not to, they can watch it live streamed on DPTV and see for themselves, listen to the messages. And the one thing I should, you know, bring up at this very point is the chamber always leaves the conference with to-do items, three or four items that come out during the discussions of the week that are most important. We take those away to get something done, and we work with other organizations. The Chamber doesn't do it alone, and we can't do it alone.
Today is the opening day of the 2017 Mackinac Policy Conference put on by the Detroit Regional Chamber, and we've been getting a preview as we talk with Tammy Carnreich, the COO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Tammy, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside today.
Thank you, Cynthia. I hope you have a great day.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's an irresistible energy and life to bluegrass music. The nonstop rhythms of the banjo, mandolin, fiddle, and bass, plus the vocal harmonies that make this music so rich, can make just about anyone want to jump up and dance. Mark Lavengood of Grand Rapids is a musician who got hooked on old-time music, and now he's sharing that passion with the rest of us.
Yeah, well, bluegrass is a style of music that is just so upbeat. You know, it can be slower, but, you know, by and large, you hear bluegrass and you think, oh, yeah, Foggy Mountain Special, Earl Scruggs, you know, the Andy Griffith Show, if you're older. I know that was actually some of my earliest influences of bluegrass was my pops watching the Andy Griffith Show. And at the time, you know, I didn't really pay much attention to it because I was a little kid just bopping around, but as I kind of grew into my own musical self, my buddies, they brought this style of music to me. When I came to it, just like, it fills me with so much positive energy. It just makes me want to dance. It makes me want to bounce. It makes me want to sing. You know, the three-part harmonies that are so idiosyncratic of the style, kind of pulled, you know, from gospel and early folk traditions. You know, that's such a powerful element of the music as well. It grips people. You know, you hear three-part harmonies saying pure, crystal clear, and you just can't help but feel it in your soul.
Lavengood plays a dobro and steel guitar along with other instruments. He's been touring with Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies and the Mark Lavengood Bluegrass Bonanza. Now this singer-songwriter is releasing his third full-length album. It's titled We've Come Along.
So musically with the title track, it kind of reflects more of a progressive bluegrass vibe, you know, think Green Sky Bluegrass or Infamous String Dusters, Bela Fleck, you know, Jerry Douglas. Those are all my mentors, and musical inspiration that I've been listening to as I've been growing, you know, my own in the acoustic world.
Ain't got no baby by my side, but that don't keep me lonely. Memories they fill space eternally, and the miles at the wheel where they keep on rolling. We've come a long way now, and we learn so how to get by. All right.
Lyrically, the song kind of paints a picture of in a relationship and, you know, kind of gone separate ways. This particular relationship, it was also hard because it was at a really integral point in my life where I was transitioning from being a part-time musician to being a full-time musician, and the strains that that brought upon the relationship just kind of open up to the differences and just respect the fact that, you know, they're on a different path, and right now we're all doing what we want to be doing, hopefully. And that's kind of, you know, one of the underlying messages is the hope that we all can aspire to live anew, to find some sort of purpose, you know, in the midst of any sort of calamity.
We've come a long way.
So this next song is titled America, and it's a social protest song of sorts. I wrote it, it's probably the oldest song selections for We've Come Along. I wrote it back probably 2009, I want to say, right when I was kind of making that initial push to start playing music.
Took them from their land, shipped them overseas, replaced them, replaced and repeat. Came time to ask them for their keys, homesteads of land their own. This land's not yours to give or to keep. This land is for you and for me. But I will serve so that I might be free from all the
time I was reading Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States for the first time, and it was just absolutely revolutionary. You know, it opened my mind and my, you know, eyes to so many things that I was kind of living in and witnessing, but didn't have the right syntax to kind of put to words. You know, in the end, the last verse is kind of a call to arms of sorts, but, you know, not guns, not swords, like our actual arms. People, let's get our arms together. Let's bring them together. Let's build what needs to be built. You know, let's expose, you know, all the falsities and bring truth back to the matter.
Takes you and I, and it takes all our lives.
Mark Lavingood will play new music from his album We've Come Along at the Arc in Ann Arbor on June 1st.
To be or not to be? That is the question.
Let's check out what's on stage now from professional theater companies all around Michigan as we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And David, we're going to start out in Waterford Township with a company that you think is very well worth checking out.
Absolutely. It's called the Monster Box Theater, and it's in Waterford, which is a little north of West Bloomfield. Mm-hmm. And it's one of our, what I call our strip mall theaters. It doesn't sort of stick at us in a big place, but it is a very interesting space. They actually have two theater spaces inside. And I've seen stuff from David Mamet and Neil Simon. They have acting camps for young folks. It's really a little gem inside Waterford. And they are putting on Fuddy Mears, which was the first major work by playwright David Lindsay Abaire.
What's this one about?
This one revolves around a character called Claire, who has what is called psychogenic amnesia. And she awakens each morning with absolutely no memory of anything that has transpired on the preceding day. Her husband tends to her basic needs while continuously trying to jog her memory. It sounds a bit like a movie with Drew Barrymore called 51st Dates.
Yes, I remember that.
And I kind of think, although I did look this up, they don't admit to this play inspiring the movie, but it's kind of hard to believe that it didn't.
So was it a romantic comedy? Like, yeah, 51st Dates?
Exactly,
was?
Yeah. Okay. It has that feel to it, but it's called Fuddy Mears.
Okay.
And it's at the Monster Box in Waterford Township.
And over to the Detroit Repertory Theater and the final show of its 60th year, which is...
It's called Countdown to the Happy Day, and it's by playwright Thomas W. Stevens. It's a world premiere, and I want to talk just a minute about the theater company itself, because some people may not be familiar that this has been in continuous operation, the Detroit Rep, since Eisenhower was in the White House. Okay?
You stop and say 60 years. That's
impressive. Yeah, it's amazing. And the show actually premiered on May 25th. But it'll run for 5 weeks through June 25th. And for those of you who haven't been, it's a real experience. The first time I went, I was really taken. It's in a part of Detroit that has seen far better days, on Woodrow Wilson Street. But the Rep stands in this neighborhood like a beacon. And the patrons are so wonderful that have supported the Rep over the years. I always meet new people when I go there. And there's a bar in the lobby, mm-hmm. so you can get a little drink beforehand.
And what is Countdown to the Happy Day about?
So the story focuses on a character called Gertie, who is a troubled Army veteran, self-made bag lady, if you will, who encounters a character named Kirvin, who's just kind of described in the play as a hulking seventh-grade dropout. And it's kind of an emotionally combustible relationship. You know, one of the things that Detroit Rep specializes in is all of the plays that they do have some connection to race relations, civil rights, human rights. There's always some thread there. And so this play is no exception.
Very worth exploring.
And I also want to just give a little plug to a woman named Sandra Love Aldridge, who's been an actress there, and she's making her directorial debut with this play.
Very good. Now we head to Dexter, to Encore Musical Theater, bringing one of my personal favorites, Lerner and Lowe's Camelot. And I would like to say it's perfect for the lusty month of May, but it doesn't open until June 8th.
Right. It does open in June. It would have been perfect if it opened in May. And this is, you know, we've talked about some of these edgy comedies, modern comedies. So nice contrast. You go with sort of golden oldie musical from the 60s at the Encore Musical Theater, and Stephen West, who usually graces the stage at the Encore Musical Theater every summer in a big show. He's playing King Arthur. He's also at the U of M department. And he's also sung at just about every major opera stage in the world, So
you're getting a good set of pipes.
I can't imagine too many people who would be a better King Arthur. And of course, the music is great. And there's great, memorable tunes.
In fact, let's get everyone in the mood by hearing a bit from the wonderful 1960 Broadway cast recording of Camelot, the one I burned a hole in as a kid, with Richard Burton and Julie Andrews as Arthur and Guinevere.
If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer. Seeing you in summer, I never would go. Your hair streaked with sunlight, your lips red as flame, your face with a luster that puts gold to shame. But if I'd ever leave you, how could it be in autumn? How I'd leave in autumn, I never would know. I've seen how you sparkle when fall nips the air. I know you in autumn, and I must be there.
You know, hey, kids, we should let you all know, too, that the one and only Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is, of course, the brilliant creator of Hamilton, cut his teeth listening as a little boy incessantly to that very soundtrack, talks about it every chance he can in every interview, and he loves to point out the kind of lyricism that's in this and how it works with the music. So you can listen to what influenced the creator of Hamilton by going to Camelot.
I have heard him talk about that, and I hear he's been pretty successful on his own, having cut his teeth that way.
Kind of done all right. Over to the Williamston Theater near East Lansing, which is an appropriate setting for a play about an English professor.
Yeah, it's called Taking Shakespeare, and it's a play by John Murrell. And this is kind of a gentle comedy. It's a little bit about the power of storytelling. Official opening night was May 26th, but it runs for several weeks through June 18th. This is a story about kind of a downtrodden, kind of moldy English professor who is tapped to mentor and tutor the dean's son through this freshman Shakespeare class.
I already know that. Tell me something else.
I want to go somewhere. I'd travel some more if I could.
Instead of going to school?
Yes.
Where would you go?
Venice.
Why?
Because that's where this happens.
Only the first act?
Because he was Othello, the Moor of Venice. And I've read the whole thing, three acts, and I'm going to read the rest again tonight.
Shakespeare never went to Venice.
He must have.
There's absolutely no evidence.
I don't care. He went all these places. He did all this shit. Oh, farewell, farewell, the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit-stirring drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner and all quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. And oh, you mortal engines whose rude throats the immortal Jove's dread clamors counterfeit, farewell. Othello's occupation's gone. Was Shakespeare ever in the army?
There's no evidence.
He was, though. And he went to Venice and Cyprus and... And he was black. Shakespeare was black. All the evidence is right here.
So you get this very strong relationship kind of story.
Are we echoing Dead Poets Society here, or Goodbye, Mr. Chips, or a little different?
No,
path?
Because it's really I believe it's a two person cast, so it's a more intimate show than that. And there's also, I should point out for people who like these sorts of things, there's a Conversation Sunday for the show on Sunday, June 11th. And that's where the audience gets to do some talk back with the director and some of the cast members.
All right. So to recap our offerings, the Monster Box Theater in Waterford Township presents Fuddy Mears by David Lindsay Abaire. The Detroit Repertory Theater capping off its 60th year with Countdown to the Happy Day by Thomas Stevens. Encore Musical Theater in Dexter presenting Camelot running from June 8th to July 2nd. And the Williamston Theater has Taking Shakespeare by John Murrell. And of course, you can get the details on these and other productions all around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Challenge. Opportunities.
The next idea.
Education is not a mechanical system. It's a human system. It's about people.
The nature of higher education is changing. from how it's delivered to what it costs to what advantages it actually gives to those who graduate. The next idea is Jeff DeGraff has been noticing mixed messages lately about the intrinsic and financial worth of a college degree.
Recently, I read a story in the LA Times entitled, "A Sea of Despair, White Americans Without College Degrees Are Dying Younger." It was about a Princeton study on mortality rates. Apparently, all ethnic groups are living longer with the exception of white Americans. The researchers suggest that decades of underemployment have had a damaging effect on the group's financial and personal decisions, making them an easy target for profiteers and ideologues. The message: you need a college education if you don't want to die young. A few weeks earlier in The Economist, I read this: Lifelong Learning, How to Survive in the Age of Automation. The article is filled with stats on how a college education no longer means a good job. It suggests that massive open online courses, those free online lectures, may replace universities in the near future, and even intimates that technology itself is taking the best jobs. The message here? A college education is of limited value given the rapid pace of technology. A sure sign that there's a major pivot in a company or a market or a culture is the presence of a distinct incongruity like this one. So which is it? Do we skip college and die young, or do we go to college and waste our time and money? The correct answer is neither. The original purpose of a college education was to cultivate a quality of mind, to impart in the student a wider worldview. However, a college degree has also been a hallmark of class distinction and privilege. Though big steps were taken after the Second World War to democratize educational opportunities, a diploma still represents the great divide between the haves and have-nots in our country. This is even more apparent now that the exorbitant cost has put a college degree out of reach for so many. Universities still exist because knowledge directly translates into skills deemed worthy by society. But those skills constantly change with new discoveries, technologies, and even language. Miss the shift and you're left behind. The ability to make informed decisions, manage resources, communicate ideas, and coordinate communities is essential in our global marketplace. But keeping up with the Joneses requires constantly keeping up with the latest findings. Colleges and universities are finally getting the message. Professional schools are adding compulsory lifelong education to their curriculum, so skills are kept current. In fact, at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, where I teach, graduates now have lifetime, tuition-free access to leadership development and executive education. So why not take the next step? There are many on-demand providers that currently deliver college curriculum. Granted, some are degree mills of little value. But a real innovation would be if a college diploma was treated as a work in progress, an ongoing accumulation of certifications. Think of it like earning Boy Scout badges, a financial management badge, a data analysis badge, and a product development badge. 3 badges and you're a tenderfoot. 30 and you're an Eagle Scout. Or, if you prefer, a brownie or a cadet. You get the picture. Ideally, our education would resemble our careers, where we build our credentials over a lifetime of work. The needs of a disenfranchised social class and the availability of lifelong learning could be a powerful combination, with the potential to help reestablish our missing middle class. It may not help us live longer, but it might just help us live better.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea. You'll find his essay at the Next Idea link. Just go to michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Here in Michigan, taxes have been cut for businesses. Lawmakers have cut money going to municipalities, and they're in relentless pursuit of ways to reduce the income tax, even if, in the end, it amounts to very little relief for the average taxpayer. A new report indicates all these efforts have done nothing to help struggling families earn better wages. The group Michigan Future has some suggestions. Lou Glazer is president of Michigan Future, and he spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
Let's start with some basics. The governor and other politicians point to low unemployment. That is the way we determine economic progress in Michigan. Your report indicates that's the wrong measurement. What is the best way to assess whether Michigan's economy is working?
Well, I think the broadest measure is per capita income. It's really it is this notion. Ultimately, as we say in the report, you know, Ronald Reagan famously said a job is the best social program. We say in the report a good paying job is the best social program. And the reality is that we now have what people are calling this great decoupling, which is where the headline numbers on the economy actually look fine and lots of families are not doing well. So
wages are stagnant.
Wages are falling.
Are falling.
More and more work is contingent, so people are working part-time. So if you look at the ALICE report, which is this acronym that the Michigan Association in United Ways came up with to talk about families that are not able to pay basic necessities, Michigan's unemployment rate at a 15-year low. The auto industry selling as many cars as it ever has. 40% of Michigan households can't pay basic necessities. 40% is a huge number. This has never happened before. And if you look at Robert Putnam's Our Kids book, which is sort of the best description of what's going on in American households, he basically is arguing that 25% of American households are doing well, almost all college educated, 75% are not. So whether you're using 40 or 75%, there is a lesson that we need to learn, which is the economy can be doing fine and lots of folks not doing fine.
Well, the economy's changed a lot. I mean, since workers with high school diplomas could secure a good living in the auto industry, the report says globalization and technology such as automation are, quote, mega forces that are transforming the economy. Your report indicates Michigan needs to align rather than resist these new realities. What do you mean by that?
Right. So I think, you know, we've been trying to get people to understand that. So, you know, I've been working in this area. Michigan Future is 25 years old, the think tank that I run. But before that, I worked in state government for a while. So 35 years or so, I've been working on sort of the Michigan economy. And for that entire period of time, politicians of both parties have campaigned on they can make a high-paid, factory-driven economy work again. That economy is gone. We cannot – success is not about turning the clock back. Success is about figuring out how you have a high-prosperity economy in the context of the world in which we live now. And that world is increasingly being defined by automation, by smarter and smarter machines, which are increasingly doing work that humans used to do. And unless we're aligned with that, unless we are figuring out ways in which to help people get good-paying jobs that are available today, not that were available 20 or 50 years ago, we're going to continue to be poor.
The report says you want the state's economic policies to have a single goal. Raising
right.
household income for Michigan
yes.
residents. A graphic in the report shows nearly every county in Michigan shows a decline between 11% and 32% in real median household income from 1999 to 2014. What can state government do to reverse that trend?
Yeah. So that map, which comes from the Harvard Business School, is sort of like a picture is worth a thousand words. It is astonishing. That map shows not just that every county in Michigan has had this substantial decrease in household income over the last 15 years. But if you look at the map, Michigan stands out compared to the rest of the country. We, compared to the country, have had a horrible 15 years. So this is structural. It is not cyclical. You cannot blame this on single state recession or the auto industry not doing
well. Lost decade.
The lost decade, all the rest of this stuff turns out not to be an accurate assessment. So the most startling statistic in this report is in 2000, the last time the auto industry was selling 17 million units a year, employment earnings, which is wages and benefits per capita for Michiganders, was basically 1% below the national average. In 2015, it's 16% below. So unless, and work is how people pay the bills. You cannot be 16% below the national average and have a high prosperity Michigan. So the levers that are available to state government, the first and most important is increased education attainment. All of the data off the chart is people earn more and work more, higher education. It is not an accident that Michigan is 32nd in per capita income and 32nd in college attainment. Increasingly, they go together. So increased education attainment is by far the most important lever. And that actually is something that states do control more than the feds, from early childhood through college. And the argument we make in the report is really threefold. First is that we've got an education system at the moment that is basically designed for the 75% for non-affluent kids to prepare them for 20th century jobs, not 21st century careers. So you've got to change sort of how schools are designed. Secondly, we've got a way too laissez-faire system of accountability where it's almost okay for the system not to work. And the reality is early childhood, K-12 education, higher education, and even more so adult training have horrible results for everybody except affluent kids and adults, and we got to change that. And third, this is back to your tax point. We've decided tax cuts are more important than funding education. It's stupid. It's exactly the wrong decision.
You're talking about higher education and how, you know,
right,
they do better. But we all have different potentials. I mean, not everyone's going to participate in the high-wage, knowledge-based economy.
Yep.
What should government policy be regarding to make sure that they're not, those people are not, economically speaking, left behind?
Exactly. So, you know, this is something that sort of surprised us as we got into this. You know, the United Way report makes this pretty clear. About half the jobs in Michigan don't pay enough to raise a family kind of thing. So and that's structural. It's not changing. So we basically argue in the report that shared prosperity is one of these levers that state government is going to have to use, which means a better training system to help get people into the workforce and those who are working part-time to full-time. But it also means that you've got to augment wages and benefits either through, you know, government programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit or health insurance for everybody or employer mandates like raising the minimum wage. If you don't do that, you're not changing this 40% number.
Yeah, the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, was cut, what, 2 years ago, three years ago, and hasn't been restored at all, which was one of the real benefits to a working person. Came to us from Gerald Ford. I mean, it was
Ronald Reagan.
Okay,
it was Reagan called it the best poverty program ever, and he was right.
The Michigan Future Report also talks about creating places where people want to live and work.
Right.
How is state government approaching that now?
A little bit better than it has historically. So basically, why this matters is talent's mobile. So, you know, we know it here in Ann Arbor. You finish at the University of Michigan and go any place on the planet. They take the Michigan economy with them when they go someplace else. And Michigan, even with a strong economy, is still a net exporter of talent. And so what we argue is that creating places where people want to live and work, which to us means places that have quality infrastructure, basic services and amenities, particularly central cities because that's where young professionals want to live, is an essential ingredient to an economic development strategy for three reasons. The first reason is companies increasingly are moving to where talent is rather than talent moving to where the jobs are. And you see that across the country. Second, talent, particularly young professionals, are the folks that are starting new businesses that create high-wage jobs. So it's the core of economic development. Third, they're the new middle class that spends money in the community buying homes, buying cars, shopping at the stores, going to restaurants. So, and at the moment, so what we say in the report is that that Metro Detroit and Metro Grand Rapids, but particularly those two cities, have got to be competitive with the big talent magnets around the country like Chicago and New York, San Francisco, Seattle, you name it. And at the moment, they aren't. Making progress, but not competitive.
As we mentioned earlier, there's resistance to raising taxes. The steady drumbeat in Lansing is to cut taxes as a way to economic well-being. So how can the state pay for these recommendations you're talking about, and is there the political will to do that?
Well, the way you pay for it is higher taxes, and there's not the political will to do it at the moment. Part of what the report is doing is basically trying to provide all the data possible that basically says two things. One, Michigan has been cutting taxes. There's a great Citizen Research Council report on this for 30 years. And for the last 20 of those 30 years, we've gotten consistently poorer. Our per capita income is going down, not up. So it hasn't worked. But secondly, when you look at all the – so of the 15 states that have the highest per capita income, three are oil and gas dependent.
What states are they then?
The three states – top 15 states in per capita income, three are oil and gas dependent, North Dakota, Wyoming, and Alaska. Of the other 12, all 12 are in the top 15 in the proportion of adults with four-year degrees. Almost none of them are low-tax states. So if you look at the path to prosperity, the path to a large middle class, it is increased education attainment, not low taxes. The highest, by far, the best economic outcomes in the Great Lakes and actually in cold weather states is Minnesota. They're the highest tax state in the Great Lakes.
The report's out. There are some heavy hitters on your board.
Yep.
What kind of response are you expecting from Lansing?
You know, it's interesting. Our assumption is – so Michigan Future has been around for 25 years. This is the first time that we've done a policy report. And the reason we did a policy report was is that we had assumed over the years that our ideas and information would be powerful enough that people would run with it, and it sort of isn't happening. So I think our assumption has been all along is that we want to use the report to try to get candidates in 2018. So we're really looking out, not now, out to actually run on this and have a debate about this, which is the debate we need in this state is twofold, which you're not having now. The first is, how do you raise household income for all Michiganders? No one's talking about that. And second is, how do you do that in the context of a world in which jobs are changing so dramatically? If we can get both parties to have some candidates running on these ideas, that will be victory for us.
Lou Glaser is the president of Michigan Future. The report we've been talking about is called A Path to Good-Paying Careers for All Michiganders, a 21st Century State Policy Agenda. Thanks for explaining the proposal.
Yep, MichiganFuture.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings and Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Josh Hakala. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.